Irwin R. Scheister has a real treat for you today. I'm going to be giving you some tax tips. Number three, having your daughter's buck teeth fixed doesn't constitute a proper medical claim. Number two, try mailing your return on time for a change. And the number one tip, quit your crying and pay what's due, or IRS will audit you.
Welcome to episode 214 of the Sala Monster Sounds Off on SEScoops.com. It is Sunday, April 15th, 2012. I am the Sala Monster. Hope everybody has their taxes paid up by now. It is, of course, tax week. I think Tuesday is the official deadline for taxes here in the U.S. And if you do not pay your fair share, you will be visited by Irwin R. Scheister. So pay up. We have a lot to get to this week. Thoughts on Raw, Live SmackDown, which was a kind of a throwback show this week. I actually did manage to catch the entire show. It's also going to mark the return of Match Anatomy, first Match Anatomy on this show since episode 202, and I think the subject for Match Anatomy this week is actually quite perfect, so we'll get to that a little bit later on. Plus, I got some thoughts on Scott Hall and some other good stuff. Also, I just want to mention here at the top another thank you to all the people. I still am getting feedback from some of the recent episodes of The Sound Off last week, of course, episode 212 from Miami. Me and my cohorts, Noah Mark and Brian Blade, and the interviews with the WWE superstars. Again, thank you for all the feedback. It's been very positive, I'm happy to say. And also, again, there are up to 100 photos that I posted on Facebook recently from WrestleMania weekend in Miami. I've gotten a lot of people kind of friending me on there so they could check all out the photos and the videos and all that stuff. If you missed it, if you want to see it, friend me on Facebook, and everything is up there. So thank you for that. I also apparently got a lot of emails from you guys because I forgot to mention in all of the mass WrestleMania hysteria in reviewing Mania and Raw the next night in Miami, I forgot to mention the fact that Brodus Clay was on both shows. The Funkasaurus, one of my favorites, and somehow this managed to kind of fall under the radar. I completely neglected talking about Brodus Clay. So for the people who pointed that out, thank you. I obviously enjoyed Brodus Clay being on both shows because I was there. And I could listen to his music. But more importantly, on Raw last Monday night, it was good to see him used in a role other than just coming out and squashing another guy like a Curt Hawkins or a Tyler Rex. You know, he came out to assist Santino Marella, gave Dolph Ziggler a pretty brutal headbutt to the chest, I think it was, and Ziggler took a bump on the stage that looked like it sucked. But what I liked about it was that it was Brodus coming out and being Brodus. He came out, he was this big, bad, you know, MF-er, and wasn't being used for comedy in that particular spot. People were chanting Funkasaurus. He kind of showed a mean streak, which continued into Raw this week, and I did like that. So I don't know how I managed to forget about that, but I did. I didn't mention him at all, so I just wanted to get that out of the way here at the top of the show this week. First thing I want to actually get to, and I know many of you may be listening to this after the pay-per-view, but there is a TNA pay-per-view tonight. It is their annual lockdown show, all matches inside the steel cage. Lockdown emanating from Nashville, Tennessee. And it's the one event that once it did something like 60,000 pay-per-view buys with a Kurt Angle, Samoa Joe main event. Suffice to say, this show won't be doing 60,000 buys, but it certainly has the potential to be a great show. Quick rundown of the card here. The main event, TNA World Heavyweight Championship on the line. It will be Bobby Roode defending the title against his former tag team partner, James Storm. I did see the face-to-face showdown between the two of them at the end of Impact this past Thursday night. Haven't been checking out too much of Impact lately, but I did watch that segment. About 8 minutes, 8-9 minutes long. It was very good. I'm not fawning over it the way, you know, some people are. It's not like the greatest promo I've ever seen, but I thought for what they were trying to accomplish by kind of rehashing the history and the background these two guys have coming up as you know, friends, tag team partners, and now, of course, mortal enemies, splicing in clips of you know, all of their, some of their matches and what happened when Bobby Roode smashed the beer bottle over Storm's head. I thought that was really well done. And hopefully they go out there tonight and just have a kick-ass match. It's just refreshing to see two guys in the main event for the World Championship in TNA who, you know, a year ago even, you probably wouldn't have seen. It would have been Sting. It would have been Kurt Angle. It would have been Hulk Hogan. It would have been somebody else. These guys have an opportunity to go out there and show everybody what they're made of, and I hope they do that. We have another match on the show that will pit Team Eric consisting of Eric Bischoff, Gunner, Bully Ray, Christopher Daniels, and Kazarian against Team Garrett. Garrett Bischoff, AJ Styles, Austin Aries, Mr. Anderson, and Rob Van Dam, who is finally back on TV. It is a lethal lockdown match. The losing captain, of course, Eric Bischoff is captaining his team, his son Garrett captaining the opposing team. The losing captain must leave TNA, and I hate stipulations like this because you just know Eric Bischoff is not going anywhere, and even Garrett Bischoff is not going away. And whoever loses, I would hope they have enough foresight to at least keep them off TV for a couple of months, but even that is probably not going to happen. So why bother with a stipulation like this? I just think it's stupid. Jeff Hardy and Kurt Angle will have a match. Angle pulled out of his Olympic trials this week, citing a hamstring injury, but he is going to soldier on for this match against Jeff Hardy. Not a wise move on his part, I would think, unless the injury is bullshit, because nobody in their right mind actually believed he was going to the Olympic trials anyway. But, you know, the idea of Kurt Angle in a cage, especially if he is hurt, oh, Kurt's always hurt. The idea of Kurt in a cage scares me, given the things that he's done before, and I would not be shocked to see a moonsault off the top of the cage. I hope I'm wrong, but I guess we'll see. But, you know, Kurt Angle and Jeff Hardy, that right there could be a show-stealing match. So I guess we'll find out. TNA Tag Team Championship on the line. Magnus and Samoa Joe against the Motor City Machine Guns. Finally back together in a big profile match. Chris Sabin has hopefully recovered from his knee injury that's kept him out for quite a while. TNA Knockouts Champion Gail Kim against Velvet Sky. We also have the TV title on the line between D-Von and Robbie E in a match between Matt Morgan and Crimson. That does not sound all that appetizing to me, but there it is. So that's the lockdown rundown for tonight. If anybody wants to check out that pay-per-view, let me know your thoughts. We'll move on here to some WWE stuff. Let's get into Monday Night Raw from last Monday night. Show from Washington, D.C., a far cry from the audience in Miami, I would say. This show was actually quite the come down from the Miami show last week. I can't even say that the D.C. crowd was bad, because I don't think it was. I think that would be unfair to the people that were in the building that night. I just think the fans in Miami last week were so goddamn awesome that when compared to a normal WWE audience, it just makes everything else look bad. It's kind of like Money in the Bank in Chicago last year. You know, same thing. That was when CM Punk had his big match with John Cena, which was a great match. It was my match of the year for 2011, but you know, you can't ignore the fact that that crowd in Chicago made that show even better than it was. And who knows? I mean, Extreme Rules in 2 weeks is in Chicago. Maybe it'll be another magical night. I guess we'll find out. This, however, was not what I would call a magical night. The show started and ended pretty good, but much of everything else was just kind of there. I didn't get the same fun feeling I got from last week's show. The biggest strike against this show to me was the Three Stooges. You know, all that crap, I could have done without that. I know some of you liked it. I actually just had a conversation with a buddy of mine about this very subject the other night, and he was a big fan of the Three Stooges stuff. He thought it was really funny, and to that I say, terrific. I hope you were entertained by it. I just didn't think it had any place on this show. The only Stooges I ever want to see on Raw are Patterson and Briscoe. That's it. You know, I was always an Abbott and Costello fan more than the Three Stooges anyway, so maybe I'm a little bit biased in that. The biggest news coming out of Raw Monday night, Brock Lesnar and John Cena will have a match. It is official at Extreme Rules April 29th in Chicago, so they are wasting no time in making Brock earn that fat new contract they signed him to, which, you know, makes sense if they're supposedly paying him something like $3 or $4 million a year. I've heard $5 million. I don't know if that's true or not, but it's a couple of million dollars for a one-year contract. And again, it's not like he's working house shows. He's working a limited number of dates each month. Kind of similar, I guess, to the deal that Goldberg had back in the day, although I think Brock is working more dates than Goldberg is. But if they're paying him all this money, you may as well use him. Michael Cole did mention the fact on this show that Brock is a former UFC heavyweight champion, so I guess their self-imposed ban on mentioning those initials is now over. John Laurinaitis brought out Brock Lesnar to start the show. He talked about bringing, Brock did, legitimacy back to WWE. He was quickly interrupted by John Cena, who was grinning and smirking even after losing both. He lost to The Rock at WrestleMania, and he got assaulted by Lesnar the very next night. But apparently he's still the happiest guy in the world. I think if you kick Cena's dog or ran him over with your car, he would probably still smirk at you. I'm pretty sure of that. Actually, it's kind of unnerving, if you think about it, that this guy always has a a smile on his face, kind of unnerving in like a Jack Nicholson The Shining sort of way. That actually would be a pretty good character for Cena if they wanted to go in that direction. Anyway, Cena is apparently now Charles Bronson and has a death wish because he walked right up to Brock Lesnar and slapped him right across the face. I'm having a hard time coming up with things in life that I would rather do less than slapping Brock Lesnar in the face. Lesnar reacted by taking Cena down and immediately punching him in the face hard. Actually, it may not even have been that hard, but when a former UFC champion punches you in the face, it's going to do some damage. And it did. It bloodied up Cena's mouth pretty good, gave him a fat lip. Brock seemed to realize he was no longer in the octagon at that point, followed up with some pretty silly-looking body shots. The entire roster spilled out of the dressing room. They tried valiantly to keep these two monsters apart, but they kept breaking free and attacking one another. I actually hated the fact that Sheamus was out there, just like another guy. I don't know if all of you picked up on that. You know, the dude is the world heavyweight champion. He shouldn't be running out there just to be another body in some pull-apart brawl. But that aside, this was actually one hell of an opening segment. One of the best I've seen on Raw in a long-ass time. This was actually really awesome stuff. The visual of Cena bleeding added so much to this. And, you know, even if he was smiling through the entire thing, you know, he was bloodied and he was still smiling. And in one way, that's kind of cool because it almost makes him... I don't want to say it makes Cena out to be a badass. The words Cena and badass don't go together, but in this case, it worked. I just really liked this segment, and it sold me on their match. You know, I was going to argue that I would have held off on Brock's first pay-per-view match a little bit longer, and that I think it's a mistake to be giving it away so early, and I still think it's a mistake, but hey, they convinced me to spend money on Extreme Rules, which I was not planning on doing, so hey, worked on me. It works on other people, too, and drives up the buy rate. It would be hard to argue that it wasn't a smart move. The problem, though, is that, you know, the perception of these B-shows is such that I don't even think Brock Wrestling is going to pop any sort of special number. I mean, The Rock Wrestling certainly didn't do much for Survivor Series, which, in theory, is still one of the traditional Big Four pay-per-views. Extreme Rules is not one of the Big Four pay-per-views. And the question is, can you really wait until SummerSlam, for example, to do the first Lesnar versus Cena match? That is a long ways away. Okay, August is a long ways away, and I don't know that WWE can wait until then. And again, they're paying Brock a shitload of money. It's kind of silly to sign him to a one-year deal and then hold him off all of your pay-per-views until August, so I get that. I actually don't blame WWE for that. You know, maybe you can build this Cena thing up a little bit more. Like, you know, Cena desperately wants a match with Brock, keeps getting beaten up by him. You build it up maybe to the June pay-per-view, whatever the hell they're calling that show now. And then after Brock wins, and make no mistake, Brock has to win. After Brock wins, you can do a deal where, you know, he wins the title maybe from CM Punk at SummerSlam. And after that, maybe it's Survivor Series. You build to a title unification bout between Brock Lesnar and Sheamus to crown one world champion, because God knows that other title is treated like shit. I like the idea, actually, of Lesnar versus Sheamus at some point. Now, I mean, to me, that would be a slugfest. That would be a hell of a match right there. That way, Lesnar keeps winning. He stays dominant. He's your sole undisputed champion. And you can build to The Rock challenging him for the title at next year's WrestleMania. You know, that's how I would probably book things, unless you wanted to do Lesnar and The Undertaker, which means that Brock would have to drop the belt before then. But personally, I like the idea of a three-way headliner next year at WrestleMania. You've got Lesnar, Rock on top, Austin Punk, if they can convince Austin to come back, and he certainly has dropped hints that he would be willing to do so, and it would be 10 years since his last match at WrestleMania against The Rock. So Lesnar, Rock, Austin Punk, and doing Undertaker and John Cena, which, as I've said numerous times before, I still maintain that Cena is the best opponent that Undertaker has never faced at a WrestleMania. You can get three big matches out of this. If you do Brock and Taker, we probably end up with Cena Rock Part 2 next year, and I'm not so sure about that one. So anyway, going to end my fantasy booking there. As far as Lesnar versus Cena goes at Extreme Rules, I know that Cena lost at WrestleMania, and actually he came out of that feud with Rock looking like a total bitch. I mean, if you really stop and think about it, from the rock bottom at WrestleMania 27 that cost Cena the match against The Miz, to Survivor Series when they teamed up, and then after the match, Rock left Cena laying with a rock bottom. To all of the promos and all the back and forth between the two of them, you know, Cena really never got his heat back on The Rock. He never attacked The Rock. He never gave The Rock another attitude adjustment. The only attitude adjustment, besides WrestleMania, that Cena had ever given The Rock was on, I think, the go-home show to WrestleMania the previous year. I thought for sure, you know, Rock left him laying at 27. He left him laying at Survivor Series. And at the end of the day, he left him laying at WrestleMania. Cena came out of this, you know, for being the top guy in the business and the top guy in the company, which he is, he came out of this looking like a bitch. And the bottom line is this. Even in spite of that, Cena cannot beat Brock Lesnar at Extreme Rules. I don't even like the idea of Lesnar having to cheat to win, but Lesnar has to look strong out of the gate. So far, he has. But if he loses in his first match, he just becomes another guy. And losing to John Cena, there's just something about Brock Lesnar, a UFC heavyweight champion, losing to John Cena in his first match back that just does not sound right to me. I can see some sort of screwy finish involving laryngitis. But, you know, I've had people write in asking me what the chances are that Cena might take a few months off, perhaps. So that way you can have Brock murder him at the pay-per-view. Maybe Brock loses the match, technically, but only by DQ in the process of just destroying Cena, who then disappears for a couple of months. I actually like the idea of Cena going away for a couple of months. And God knows if anyone deserves some time off and can use that time off to freshen up his act, it's John Cena. But here's a company that had the guy fired once in storyline, and they could not keep him off TV for more than 1 week, if that. I don't even know if he missed a week. That was when you know, the whole Nexus thing, and he you know, ref the Randy Orton Wade Barrett match and called it right down the middle, and so he was fired. Remember that whole ridiculous storyline? He was fired, yet he was never gone. They couldn't even keep him off television because they were so terrified of the idea of having a show without John Cena. I have a very difficult time believing that, with ratings already hovering at low levels, that they can keep their top guy off TV for 3 or 4 months. I just find that impossible to believe. They should do it, I just don't think they're going to. Moving on here, we had Brodus Clay and Santino Marella, who appear to be a tag team now, beat Jack Swagger and Dolph Ziggler. It's great to see them finally doing something different with Brodus, like I said, and I loved him getting the pin, but poor Dolph Ziggler. I mean, what did this guy do to deserve this? That's the one problem, I think, with him being so goddamn great at taking bumps and that sort of thing, is that you become so great at it that all they want you to do is kind of take bumps for people and not actually get over yourself. And I think that's the problem that we're seeing with Dolph Ziggler now. I don't like it. A still bloody John Cena approached laryngitis backstage in a segment, demanded that Big Johnny put him in a match with someone, anyone, doesn't matter who. So naturally, laryngitis chose David Otunga to face John Cena in the main event. David Otunga in the main event on Raw. Well, as someone tweeted to me, at least they actually had a match as the main event this week. That is true. That is true. I think it might have actually been the first time since February that Raw, for sure early March, that Raw actually had a match as its main event. So in that case, I won't complain. But still, David Otunga in the Raw main event. Jesus Christ. R-Truth beat Cody Rhodes in a nothing match after Big Show came out, distracted Cody again. Then we had Santino backstage doing comedy with Will Sasso, Sean Hayes, and Chris D'Ambo. How the hell do you even pronounce this guy's last name? It's the third actor from the Three Stooges movie. I think it's Diamantopoulos. Chris Diamantopoulos. I hope I'm right when I said that. And if I am, who gives a shit? Because I don't give a crap about this movie. They were there pimping their new movie, their new Three Stooges adaptation. Santino found them trapped inside a giant crate, and I thought for sure when he opened it up that the Spirit Squad would pop out looking for Triple H and Shawn Michaels, but sadly that did not happen. Lord Tensai, who's got some pretty badass music available right now in the iTunes store, by the way, had a match with Yoshitatsu, who was apparently there to defend all Japanese wrestlers or something like that. I believe he was upset because Tensai is not a true Japanese wrestler. I actually thought you could have told a cool little story here and maybe give Yoshi some offense, but nope. Tensai killed him dead with some headbutts, an avalanche, a Baldo bomb. Referee stopped the match again without a pin. Nobody cared. The fans chanted Albert throughout the entire match. Not good. Not good. I wonder if he will even still be Lord Tensai in a couple of months at this rate. I just still can't get over how hairy this guy used to be, and now he just looks completely different. I just picture in my head that scene from The 40-Year-Old Virgin with, you know, A-Train laying there and the lady ripping off one patch of hair at a time while he screams, Ichiban, each time. I just think that would be great. See, that's my version of comedy. Still better than The Three Stooges. CM Punk came out to cut a promo about being straight edge, and I'll be honest, it kind of bored me. I just was not interested in what he was saying. I don't know what it was. I usually like Punk stuff, but this just didn't do anything for me. Maybe subconsciously my inner alcoholic is just unhappy with all of this straight edge preaching and I just kind of tune out. I don't know what it is, but I was very happy when Chris Jericho popped up on the Titantron accusing Punk of still being... He said, Punk, are you still drunk after I attacked you last week and poured alcohol over you? I thought that was great. Jericho was sporting an awesome jacket here, by the way. He referred to Punk as CM Drunk, to which Punk said that this was no longer about who was the best in the world, but rather it was about him kicking Jericho's ass. Punk needs to stop making those really mean faces, though, because he looks completely ridiculous when he does that. But just the way he scrunches his whole face up, he looks like a cartoon character. But it would appear they're going to have a rematch in Chicago, no less, so yet another good reason to purchase Extreme Rules for Chris Jericho against CM Punk. I guess we'll find out what gimmick that match will have, because you know it's got to have a gimmick. I mean, come on. It was a bit rich to listen to Jerry Lawler on commentary act so appalled by Chris Jericho's actions when he himself did the exact same thing to Jake the Snake Roberts once upon a time, poking fun at his drinking problem and pouring whiskey down his throat, saying things like, the only two friends Jake has left are Jack Daniels and Jim Beam. By the way, based on seeing Jake myself at Wrestle Reunion, you can add Sam Adams to that list as well. Mark Henry beat CM Punk in yet another WWE Championship match, this time by disqualification, after Punk hit Henry with a monitor. And after being counted out, you know, if I didn't know any better, I'd say Punk doesn't think he can beat Mark Henry. Henry did give Punk two World's Strongest Slams afterwards, left him laying. Jericho came out, laid Punk out with a code breaker, then poured beer all over him. And not a little beer either. He poured a lot of beer on Punk, so much so that Jericho should have been given some sort of ticket or citation for wasting so much perfectly good beer on this show. Hey, maybe that could be the impetus for the Steve Austin-CM Punk feud. How about that? Austin was watching Raw week after week, sitting at home on the Broken Skull Ranch, and was angered by how much beer Punk was wasting. See, there you go. Got a ready-made storyline right there for WrestleMania next year. Alberto Del Rio beat Zack Ryder in a quick match. Ryder did nail a pretty brutal-looking kick to the face in the corner, but then he tapped out to the armbar submission. How much longer before the broski turns heel? What's the over-under on that? Because he lost his United States Championship. He lost the match for his team at WrestleMania. He continues to lose on TV each and every week. Kane put him in a body cast for 2 months. His supposed best friend, John Cena, was caught kissing his woman. Eve kicked him in the nuts. I'm just waiting for the suicide skits next. You know, those old Tim White suicide skits that they had on WWE.com. I'm just waiting for that with Zack Ryder. I mean, geez, talk about a spate of bad luck for this guy. The Two Stooges came down to the ring to no reaction from the crowd. I say Two Stooges because the third one, played by Will Sasso, came to the ring separately dressed up as Hulk Hogan to his real American theme music. He did a Hogan impersonation. It was good. It was actually very good, but not as good as the one the Big Show did at Backlash 2000 when he came out for his match against Kurt Angle as the Showster. But still pretty good. He was very orange, so at least he got that part down right. The crowd could not possibly care any less about this. In fact, they were booing this segment. I never thought I would long for the days of Kane pulling Zack Ryder down to hell, but I came pretty close here, I will say. Speaking of Kane, he came to the ring and ended up giving Sasso Hogan a choke slam while the other Stooges headed for the hills, so Kane became a babyface here to me. Mark Henry announced that next week he would get yet another WWE title match against CM Punk, but this time it would be a no countout, no disqualification match. And elsewhere, Brock Lesnar cut his first full promo. He was telling Josh Matthews that he left WWE 8 years ago and became UFC heavyweight champion, which people pop big for, by the way. He said John Cena could not hold his jock strap. Not sure why he would want to. That's pretty gross. He called himself a war machine, which is the name I actually came up with for him after Raw last week, but I didn't mention it on the sound off, and I'm pissed that I didn't mention it. It's literally the first thing that popped in my head when I was trying to think of a new nickname for Brock Lesnar. You know, you just think war machine when you look at the guy. I just didn't think WWE would actually use it, given that there's an actual MMA fighter that goes by the name War Machine. In fact, I think he had his name legally changed to that. So anyway, this was a really good promo. He didn't stammer. He didn't stutter. He sounded genuine. He sounded like a guy that could murder you if you looked at him cross-eyed. John Cena beat David Otunga in the main event. Just think about that sentence for a second. Is it any wonder why Raw's ratings have sunk to depressing levels of late? After the match, Brock Lesnar ran in and kicked Cena from behind right in the balls. And then he gave him another F5 for good measure. The fans chanted one more time, but Lesnar, being the good heel that he is, refused. That was quite great. So they started out strong, they ended the show strong, which I guess is really all anybody is going to remember anyway, so I guess it was a good show. It wasn't a bad show. It wasn't great either, so it was just kind of in the middle. Interesting to note that there was no Divas match on Raw this week. Actually, it might have been the second straight week that we had no Divas match. Kelly Kelly did beat one of the Bellas on Superstars. Speaking of the Bellas, the Bella Twins, Nikki and Brie, are apparently on their way out of WWE. They are officially done with the company once their deals expire on April 30th. They've been with WWE since 2007, I believe. And again, they're not being fired. They're not being released. They elected not to renew their contracts for whatever the reasons are. Apparently, they're already signed up for some conventions and autograph appearances. And I guess they were unhappy and they just don't want to be on the road anymore. They haven't said anything publicly. I'm sure they will once they are actually out of WWE. Cannot wait for that Bella Twins shoot interview. That ought to be something. I, for one, will look back fondly on their run. You know, whoring it up with the guest hosts on Raw every week. And, well, I mean, that's pretty much it. I don't think they really did much else in WWE. So there you go. Bella Twins on their way out. SmackDown this week was a live show on Tuesday night. It did air on Friday as well. It was a replay of the Tuesday show. It was the Blast from the Past episode of SmackDown, which when I first heard that it was a Blast from the Past show and they were going to have all these legends, I was actually quite excited because I remember the old school Raw that WWE did in November of 2010. It was the only time they did it. I was very disappointed they didn't bring it back last year. And I figured that this show would be done in a similar vein where they would have legends, yes, but they would also kind of do up maybe the set in an old-school fashion, have the old-school red, white, and blue ring ropes, and just really, I mean, they did a hell of a job on that show in 2010, and I was hoping for the same thing here, and unfortunately, that is not what we got. And if anything, well, we'll get into it here with the legends. We had a whole bunch of legends on this show. Mick Foley was there. Rowdy Roddy Piper, Million Dollar Man, was there. Sergeant Slaughter, Hacksaw Jim Duggan, Dusty Rhodes, Bob Orton Jr., Tony Atlas, Pat Patterson, Hillbilly Jim, Jimmy Hart, Mean Gene Okerlund, and Howard Finkel. Now, Foley is not on the Legends House show, nor is DiBiase, I believe, but I think everybody else is. So this was basically a collection of people from that Legends House reality show that they just wrapped up filming recently. And I can say that I'm actually just happy I got to meet three of these guys during WrestleMania weekend. So, yeah, I got to meet Jimmy Hart, Tony Atlas, and Howard Finkel, so that's pretty cool. But by the time this show was over, now, when I first heard that these guys were going to be on SmackDown, I thought for sure there was going to be some sort of announcement that Legends House was coming to Sci-Fi in a couple of weeks. That had been the rumor that if, in fact, Legends House was going to get a television slot, if they did not want to wait for the new network to launch, if it ever launches at this point, it would be on Sci-Fi probably in mid to late April. So I thought, okay, perfect. That's probably what they're going to announce. In fact, by the time this show was over, it was obvious that there is no deal with Sci-Fi to air Legends House, which means that we're going to have to pretty much wait, and that show is going to be sitting in the can until the new network launches, which would be November at the earliest. So, I mean, unless they choose to air it on their YouTube channel, which would be more an act of desperation than anything else, but I think they're just going to hold it for the new network. And I've said before, you're dealing with legends. God forbid anything happens, but you're dealing with older wrestlers. A lot can happen between now and November. It would really, really suck if, God forbid, something happened to one of these guys and they were no longer around and you have this TV show that's going to air. I'm sure that has, you know, these contrived storylines and some of these guys are not going to be painted in the best light. There's a lot of things that can go wrong. I'm hoping they find a home for this show before November, but it doesn't look like it. Mean Gene started the show out. He introduced Sheamus to start the program. World Champion came out. He apologized for giving referee Chad Patton a brogue kick last week out of frustration. John Laryngitis came out. He forced Sheamus to apologize a second time because he didn't hear him the first time. He said he missed it. Sheamus obliged, and apparently that was not good enough for our esteemed GM, because Big Johnny then proceeded to place Sheamus on permanent probation and fine him a record $500,000 for his actions. $500,000. And they wonder why nobody takes this shit seriously. Who in their right mind above the age of 7 could possibly buy into this? I mean, you want to find the guy, make an example out of him, go right ahead. Fine him $25,000, even $50,000. But $500,000? Whatever. He announced the main event would be Daniel Bryan and Alberto Del Rio against Sheamus and Mean Gene Okerlund. I was very disappointed that Gene did not tell Laryngitis to blow it out of his ass like he did once on WCW Thunder to Mark Madden. Mark Henry and Randy Orton had a match. Orton was still... he still has not avenged those two pay-per-view losses to Mark Henry last year. He did not do it here either, thankfully. Kane interrupted on the Titantron with his usual corny, badly written monologue, and they panned out and showed Randy's dad, Cowboy Bob Orton, laid out on the ground. So Orton ran backstage to his father's aid. I don't think there was an actual finish here. Maybe Orton got counted out and Henry won, I don't know. Orton did eventually find his dad, but Kane ambushed him with a lead pipe and left him laying. Kane then kneeled over both Ortons and said that he is a sucker for family reunions. So I thought that was an amusing line. We had another Ryback squash, Skip Sheffield, in his new gimmick. He killed some poor dude with a clothesline that just hurt me watching it. Holy shit, he turned this guy inside out. They showed Tony Atlas, Ted DiBiase, and Pat Patterson, and Hillbilly Jim watching backstage on a screen. They were laughing at the poor destruction of this man. You know, it's way too early to know where they're going with Ryback, but remember, I said there were big things in this guy's future before he got hurt. You know, back when he was with the Nexus. I envisioned him eventually turning against Wade Barrett, much the same way that Batista did with Triple H and Evolution. You know, Vince McMahon supposedly, once upon a time, felt the same way about Skip Sheffield. He was telling people that he saw Ryback eventually being the number two babyface in the company behind John Cena. I mean, that was then, this is now. Let's see what they do with him, but certainly he looked impressive here. We had Tyson Kidd and Heath Slater backstage. They were preparing for their match with the Usos. Slater said that he had enlisted the services of a manager that told him he had the potential to be the next Honky Tonk Man. He was so honored by this. By the way, have you seen the video of Flo Rida training and responding to Heath Slater's insults on Twitter? Apparently, Slater has been in a Twitter war with Flo Rida. After Flo, I'll just call him Flo because we're tight, shoved him into a wall in that backstage segment at WrestleMania. So apparently this was the start of a feud between the two of these men. I had no idea this was going on, but then I saw the video of Flo sparring and saying that he was coming for the one-man Southern Rock Band. Sure does look as if they're going to do a match. My guess would be SummerSlam in L.A. If they can drag it out, I don't know, but I can think of people other than Heath Slater. If you're going to do a celebrity angle like this, I guess we'll see where it goes. Maybe they figure it's something that Slater can do to help get over. I don't see how that's possible, because if this match actually does happen, you know, Slater's going to look like a complete goofball. He's going to get his ass kicked by a non-wrestler. I don't see how that helps you get over. You know, wrestling Lawrence Taylor in the main event of WrestleMania 11 did not get Bam Bam Bigelow any more over than he already was. So I think Heath Slater's going to be in the same spot regardless. But Slater brought in Jimmy Hart as the manager for him and Kidd that night on SmackDown. I would be totally fine, by the way, with Jimmy Hart being brought back as a manager. We had a chance to meet with Jimmy briefly in Miami when we were doing our interviews, and the man is timeless. He is ageless. He does not look any older than he did 25 years ago. The only difference is that he was rocking an amazing tan that made me look like Sheamus' little cousin standing next to him. But anyway, Slater said that he had with him the... actually, not Slater, but Jimmy Hart said when we talked to him in Miami that he actually had on him the megaphone that he used at WrestleMania 3, but I doubt that was the one he used on this show. Heath Slater then proceeded to completely disgrace the good name of the Honky Tonk Man by losing to the Usos. Mick Foley was on commentary for this match. I wonder if Vince McMahon was screaming in his ear on headset just for shits and giggles. Foley grew agitated at Jimmy Hart yelling into his microphone throughout the match, and he whipped out Mr. Socko, chased Jimmy Hart around the ring, and gave him the mandible claw after the match. What made this so sad to me was the complete lack of reaction from the crowd. Even Michael Cole on commentary made a flippant comment basically alluding to the non-reaction that this was getting. That was actually the theme of this entire show. These fans did not give a shit about any of the legends, except maybe for Roddy Piper. It was actually quite depressing, but you know, you have a lot of kids in the audience, and I'm sorry, but Hillbilly Jim, who doesn't even look like he used to look, it's not like he still walks around wearing the overalls and the stupid hat, so, I mean, who can really recognize him? Tony Atlas and Howard Finkel, I mean, I love these guys, but you look at it from the perspective of either a kid or a newer fan, regardless of their age. These people have no idea who these legends are, and WWE doesn't exactly do a very good job of explaining that to us. I mean, they do with, you know, the big names like Piper and Foley and all that, but how's anybody supposed to care about any of these other people? I don't even really blame the fans. I just think overall it's just a very depressing situation. Speaking of Piper, he was up next for the best segment, easily the best segment on this show, a Piper's Pit with Daniel Bryan and AJ. AJ was playing up the battered girlfriend syndrome here, and she was actually quite good at it. AJ is just so damn cute. I'm sorry, but she is. She said everything was her fault. Bryan was actually a really nice guy. Piper was fuming about this, trying to convince AJ that it was not her fault. Bryan said that if you really love me, you will leave the ring right now, which is what she did. That left Roddy Piper alone with Daniel Bryan. Piper said that he had three daughters of his own, and there's three things you don't do. You don't tell them to be quiet, you don't yell at them, and you don't use them as a human shield. Piper was awesome here in this segment, and to me, you know, even more so than winning the World Heavyweight Championship, because really, everybody wins the World Heavyweight Championship these days. One of these days, I'm going to win the World Heavyweight Championship, okay? The biggest sign to me that Daniel Bryan has really made it in WWE is the fact that he was featured on a Piper's Pit. I don't think they would just waste a Piper's Pit on anybody these days. I think there's very few Piper's Pits that we have left, and the fact that they dedicated one to Daniel Bryan, to me, speaks to the confidence that they have in him as a top-flight performer. So anyway, that segment ended with Bryan slapping Piper across the face and walking out, which is at least more sensible than slapping Brock Lesnar in the face. I'll slap Roddy Piper in the face before I slap Brock Lesnar in the face. Bryan also announced during this segment that he would get his rematch against Sheamus for the championship at Extreme Rules in a 2 out of 3 falls match, which now gives me 3 reasons to purchase Extreme Rules at the end of the month. I'm hoping these guys can have the match that they were not allowed to have at WrestleMania. It's also interesting because the plan had been apparently for Alberto Del Rio to challenge Sheamus for the championship at the pay-per-view, and obviously with the reactions that Bryan has been getting coming out of WrestleMania, the way that his new t-shirt has been selling, he's opened up some eyes backstage in WWE, and they changed their plans. Now, I don't expect Bryan to win the title back. In fact, I would be stunned if they put the belt back on him, because Sheamus is their guy. And for Sheamus to win the title and lose it a month later, I mean, I guess I shouldn't say never say never, say never, because Triple H, back in 2002, he did win the Undisputed title at WrestleMania. They built that thing up from, you know, coming back from his injury and working his way back, and he won the championship, and then a month later they just put the title on Hulk Hogan. So, I mean, anything is possible. But to me, Sheamus and Bryan in a 2 out of 3 falls match, that's a kick-ass match right there. Wouldn't shock me if the first fall of that match went to Sheamus in, again, like 10 seconds or something, just to fool people into thinking that, you know, holy shit, he's going to beat Bryan again in record time. But then, you know, Bryan wins the second fall, and then it comes down to a third fall. But I guess we'll see. But I'm looking forward to that match. The Great Khali, Alicia Fox and Natalya. Wow, what a team that is. Holy shit. They beat Drew McIntyre and the Bella Twins, about 30 seconds. Alicia pinned one of the twins with a suplex. Who could possibly care about this? Do you care? Does anybody care? This was basically just there to set up a Mae Young appearance. She came out on stage after the match and got Khali down on his knees, gave him a very weak kick to the shin. Khali bent over, and Mae Young gave him a kiss. So there you go. It's always good to see Mae Young. And I love Mae Young, but not at the expense of having a match where the Great Khali is tag team partners with Alicia Fox. We had a promo for the newcomer on SmackDown, Damian Sandow. He trashed the use of social media in our society and was overall just very preachy. He's very articulate. I will give him that. He is a very well-spoken, very articulate guy. And that's about the only good thing I can say about this. Also, he reminds me of Mike Knox. Boudicco beat Hacksaw Jim Duggan in a match. Went about a minute. By this point, as much as I love the Legends, and I was a big fan, like I said, of the old school Raw and all that stuff, they jumped the shark with the Legends by this point in the show. Duggan called out Sergeant Slaughter since Hunico had Camacho in his corner. Duggan ended up using his 2x4 on Hunico and got DQ'd. Camacho got the Cobra Clutch from Sarge for good measure. This was a complete waste of time. They just completely wasted my time. They get a live slot on Tuesdays, which doesn't happen very often. I know they've gotten a couple of them already. And at one point, the hope was that eventually SmackDown would migrate from Friday nights and be live every Tuesday night. And I don't see that happening at all now, not just because this show did so piss poorly in the ratings, which it did. It got a 1.5, which is still better than Impact, but not a good number at all. And in fact, the numbers they've been doing on Friday nights are actually quite good. I don't see why they would move from Friday nights at this point. I mean, to me, Thursday night is still the ideal night. Why they didn't go back to Thursdays when they seemingly had the opportunity to do so when they went to Sci-Fi, I have no idea. And again, maybe WWE wanted it. Maybe they floated the idea, and Sci-Fi said no. Maybe that did happen. But, you know, moving SmackDown to Friday nights was a huge mistake. And even though the numbers of late have been pretty good, they would be so much better, in my opinion, on, for example, a Thursday night. But not on Tuesdays. They certainly didn't do a good job of making this show feel important. And it was this segment that really hit me. This was just a complete waste of time. They get these live Tuesday slots, and this is what they use it for. It's just unbelievable. Unbelievable. Cody Rhodes came out for an interview. He was interrupted by his father, the American Dweeb, Dusty Rhodes. You know the drill. Son of a plumber. Kings and queens. Rice and beans. Pork and beans, I think. Was it pork and beans or I don't know. All that shit. Dusty actually said that Cody was the best athlete to come to WWE since Shawn Michaels. Really? The best athlete to come to WWE since Shawn Michaels. Is that so? I can think of at least three other people right off the top of my head. Kurt Angle, Brock Lesnar, and Shelton Benjamin. And I'm sure I could come up with more. But he was out there to compliment his son, so I guess, you know, whatever. Did Cody even play any other sports before he came to WWE? I know he was a wrestler in high school, but I think that may have been it. Anyway, Cody said that Dusty was embarrassing him. Let's go backstage. Big Show came out at this point. He played another embarrassing video of Cody, this time playing up the... I think it was back during the dashing Cody Rhodes gimmick, and in this one, Cody was applying lip balm in a very fancy way, shall we say. Big Show left. He left pretty much Dusty Rhodes alone to begin dancing as Cody walked out, if you can call that dancing. Dusty was just kind of, it was more like gyrating his hips. He was standing in one position and just kind of moving his hips around. I guess if you call that dancing, then he was dancing. The fact is, the fans did not react to this at all. And as somebody pointed out to me, I believe this show emanated from Virginia, or maybe West Virginia, wherever SmackDown was. And a very good point that this person brought this up, because back in the day, in the Carolinas and Virginia and areas like that, on the East Coast, Dusty was just, I mean, he was as over as anybody. I mean, that's really when he was at his peak. It was people in those areas. Everybody knew Dusty Rhodes. Everybody loved Dusty Rhodes. They came out to see him. And here they are now, all these years later, and Dusty is on live TV in his old stomping grounds, and nobody gave a shit. Very depressing to see that. And speaking of depressing, I mean, how about Cody Rhodes here? Things were going so well for this kid, and now they just can't help themselves. They have to make everybody look like a total loser at some point. Even our reigning world heavyweight champion, Sheamus, was not immune to this treatment. Remember what happened after Sheamus won King of the Ring that one year? They put fucking antlers on his head, and he couldn't win a match to save his life. So I guess Cody is going through that process now, where he's going to come out, he's going to lose every single match, he's going to be embarrassed, and hopefully he'll be able to overcome that, because he was progressing very nicely, and I do see Cody Rhodes as a future main eventer, but you got to be very careful, because if you keep a guy at a certain level for too long, people are not going to be able to see him at any other level but that one. So hopefully this will pass, Cody will move on to something bigger and better, and he'll be okay. Main event on this show had Sheamus and Mean Gene Okerlund against Daniel Bryan and Alberto Del Rio. I am struggling to decide whether this was the better main event this week of the two shows, if this was a better main event than John Cena versus David Otunga. I think I'd rather see Mean Gene in the ring than Otunga in this spot, so I'll give the edge to this match. The heels laid out the champion. They surrounded Gene like sharks circling their prey. Mind you, Gene is almost 70 years old and has a donated kidney, so there was no way they were going to lay a finger on him. Of course, this brought out the legends, which looked like all the patients from One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest escaping the institution, coming down to the ring. Piper distracted Daniel Bryan. He then turned around right into a bro kick and was pinned, meaning technically Mean Gene Okerlund beat Daniel Bryan in a match. Let that sink in for a moment. Ricardo Rodriguez then took a whole bunch of moves from the legends and ate a bro kick of death from Sheamus. Michael Cole then came into the ring, started insulting the legends. He got decked by Pat Patterson to end the show. And that was that. That was your live SmackDown show from Tuesday night. This felt like a complete throwaway show. You take away that Piper's Pit segment and you have got nothing. This was a bad, bad show. And I don't have time to watch all of SmackDown every week. I try to check out what I can because many weeks SmackDown is the better show, the better wrestling show. And I was duped this week into watching the entire thing, and overall, it sucked. Mick Foley and Dean Ambrose, a little bit of a follow-up here from what I had mentioned last week. I alluded to a YouTube video that was recorded in Miami during WrestleMania weekend. There was a bit of a confrontation between Dean Ambrose from Developmental and Mick Foley that I postulated was probably going to be the start of an angle. Otherwise, what's the point? Apparently, they're playing this up on Twitter still. On his Twitter account, Dean Ambrose indicated that he was sent home from WWE's TV tapings on Tuesday because Mick Foley, quote, felt uncomfortable after their face-to-face over WrestleMania weekend. Sounds like it is indeed part of an angle. It will lead to, one would think, it would lead to Ambrose's TV debut at some point. I said before WrestleMania that I expected him to be on television not long after WrestleMania, as in within a few short months after WrestleMania, and it looks like it will happen sooner rather than later. And I, for one, can't wait, because I think I'm always in favor of new guys, even if I wasn't impressed by that Damian Sandow promo. Again, not his fault, just that whole preachy character just came off as fake, phony, baloney bullshit to me. But I'm always in favor of new faces on TV. I like the fact that Brock is back, and we have Lord Tensai and all this other stuff. But Ambrose is also really fucking good, so the fact that he'll be on TV soon is actually really cool. WWE, I guess what they're trying to do here, they're trying to use social media to create angles that look and feel realistic. TNA also has is kind of doing that. I, you know, for example, the Scott Steiner stuff. I've had so many people write to me, are you going to talk about Scott Steiner on the Sound Off this week? I can't wait to hear your thoughts on Scott Steiner. I'm not talking about Scott Steiner this week because I remain unconvinced that Scott Steiner's comments are part of nothing more than some bullshit Twitter angle of some kind that TNA is doing. I mean, maybe it's a shoot. Maybe he really is gone and he's just venting on Hogan and Bischoff and Garrett and all that stuff. I remain unconvinced of that. And until such time that I could be sure, I am not going to say a word about it. But anyway, back to the Foley Ambrose stuff. There was also an item this week on SEScoops.com. Mick Foley was also active on Twitter and he tweeted some interesting things. One tweet, he said, I believe I do have one more big bump left in me, delivered on my terms with a WWE superstar who respects what I have done. And then in another tweet, he said, my final bump came to me as a vision. I know exactly what I want to do, where I want to do it, and who I want to do it with. My guess would be WrestleMania is where he would want to do it. Otherwise, I mean, unless he means like a city, maybe he means New York, Madison Square Garden, something like that. Who knows? And who knows if he's referring to Ambrose in this case? But the best use of Mick Foley, first of all, the best use of Mick Foley is not in the ring, because Mick Foley's in-ring days are obviously well behind him. But if he is insistent on doing another match, I like the idea of a Foley-Ambrose match used to help get Ambrose over in this angle where, you know, Ambrose ambushed him. And the whole thing here is that he said to Mick, listen, you are responsible for an entire generation of kids destroying their bodies because they watched you. They watched you punish yourself. They watched you fly off the top of the Hell in a Cell. And look at you now. You're, you know, obviously Foley has a very good life, but physically he's a wreck. The guy is a wreck. And therefore you are responsible for these kids going out there and killing themselves. And I have friends who have killed themselves. I don't know if he meant that literally or figuratively, but I love the the kind of the basis of the whole story. I think this could really work. So if they're going to do something, I would be okay with a Foley-Ambrose match. But I just hate the way, you know, the fact that Foley looks at this, the perspective that he looks at this from as, I have one big bump left in me. Why the fuck do you need one more big bump? Why can't you just go out there, have a match with this kid? If you want to make it like a hardcore match, that's fine. And just have a brawl and help put him over. Why do you have to look at it as, I have one more big bump, I have to jump off this, or I have to fall off that, or I mean, why? Foley, you know, he ran out of bumps years ago. He shouldn't be taking bumps anymore. I mean, it's just completely ridiculous. But anyway, I guess we'll see where this goes. But I would suspect that something will happen with Foley and Ambrose in the near future. And those of you who are still unfamiliar with the name Dean Ambrose, you could also, you know, check the name John Moxley. That was his name on the indies on YouTube. Guy's pretty good. I know his character, if you look at him at FCW, on some of the FCW TV shows, because he's also been feuding with William Regal, his character may not be everyone's cup of tea, but there's definitely an old kind of loose cannon Brian Pillman type vibe to it, so I think it's great. Let's talk about Scott Hall, shall we? May as well. TMZ.com reported this week that Scott Hall was arrested on April 6th on a domestic battery charge, I think it was, after he allegedly choked his girlfriend Lisa Howell at his home after he had been drinking. And his girlfriend said that Hall had been drinking for 2 straight days when they got into an argument. Yeah, it's bound to happen, you know, when you go on a bender for 48 hours, you know, bad shit's going to happen. She said that she tried to leave in her car. Hall grabbed her by the throat, dragged her out of the car. Hall appeared to be heavily intoxicated when the police arrived. They said that Howell showed several signs of physical injury, so they arrested him on that domestic battery charge. The girlfriend has thus far refused to press charges. Hall was so drunk. This is how drunk this guy was. He was so inebriated that the jail initially refused to book him. He had to be taken to a hospital and cleared before he could be incarcerated. That's how drunk this guy was. And here's the thing. I had just gotten done reading an item from The Torch like a week or so before where Sean Waltman did an interview with them and he was talking about Scott Hall and how he was back in rehab under WWE's watch and was looking good. He said, I'll give you the exact quote. Waltman said, he was here in Clearwater recently at an intensive outpatient program and I was able to spend some time with him. He's back in the wellness program right now. He's had his ups and downs, but he's looking really good. Okay, that was from the Torch interview that Sean Waltman did. And this was like a week ago, maybe two. Kevin Nash wrote on Twitter, the only person at this point that can help Scott is Scott. Those of you that think otherwise are lost to what addiction is. I assume that Nash is responding to people who are bashing him for not doing more to help his friend, which is completely ridiculous. I mean, nobody has likely done more at this point than Kevin Nash to help Scott. There's also the story of Sean Waltman trying to hang himself down in Mexico when he was down there for a while working, and I think his girlfriend, I don't know if they're still together, but at the time he was dating the former Ryan Shamrock, if you remember Ryan, back when she played the sister of Ken Shamrock in WWE, and she found him, and it was Kevin Nash that helped, I think, get him the help that he needed as well. He had to come to his, you know, Waltman's aid. I mean, just imagine the shit that Kevin Nash has had to go through with all these people and their problems. Scott Hall, Sean Waltman, even Shawn Michaels used to be fucked up all the time. For all the things you could say about Kevin Nash, I have never heard about Kevin Nash, you know, getting, you know, hooked on drugs and being found drunk in a bar and assaulting this person and doing that. He's always the one trying to help his friends out. So I think this notion that there are people, there are actually people, they're on Twitter who write Kevin Nash, who has, you know, I'm sure is also just devastated to hear that Scott Hall has once again, I'm not even so sure that Scott Hall was ever on the wagon to begin with, but if he was, obviously he's come crashing down off of it. And this guy has to get tweets and messages from idiots out there saying, you're not doing enough to help your friend. Why aren't you with him right now? Why aren't you helping him? As though Kevin Nash is like the official guardian of Scott Hall. As though Kevin Nash doesn't have a family of his own to look after. And Scott Hall is like an underage child that Nash has to be watching at all times. Like, really, you fucking idiots? Get over yourself. Leave the poor guy alone. For God's sake, people are so stupid. Use your brain. Don't you think he's doing everything in his power to try to help his friend out? I mean, are you that fucked up on drugs yourself that you're going to tweet and assault this poor guy with messages about what a horrible person he is because, oh, you're not doing enough to help your friend. Shut up. The man can only do so much. I don't really even know what Nash can do at this point. He's got to feel helpless. If I'm him, I have a lot of sympathy in the situation for Kevin Nash. I mean, what do you do in a situation like this beyond, you know, offering, you know, emotional support and just to be there for him? And there's really nothing else he can do. Scott Hall has to want to help Scott Hall before anybody else can. And obviously, he doesn't give a shit. The problem I have with people like Scott Hall and Matt Hardy, back when he was getting arrested every other day, isn't that they have problems. Everybody has problems. When it comes to addiction, you can feel sympathy for that person because it's a disease, you know, and it doesn't go away. It's not an easy thing to overcome. My problem is when their bad behavior impacts other people's lives. Matt Hardy once drove to the airport to pick up his girlfriend and nearly ran two cars off the road. He could have killed somebody. He was a menace to society. That's where I get really pissed off. In the case of Scott Hall now, he's allegedly assaulting his girlfriend because he's too pissed drunk to realize what he's doing. That makes me angry. You want to harm yourself? Go right ahead. Be my guest. I can't imagine you or I would have gotten as many chances as Scott Hall has, or would have as many friends and fans try to come to our rescue as he has. If he wants to kill himself, I say let him. Same goes for Jake Roberts. If you saw him like I did at Wrestle Reunion down in Miami, it's a similar deal. If the guy wants to drink himself to death, then let him. The problem is that they're not just going to do it in the confines of their own home. It's going to negatively impact other lives, and that's where I have a beef. So that's my rant there on the Scott Hall deal when I heard about that story this week. A sad story that I just don't see having a happy ending. And I just hope that when that unhappy ending comes, whatever that may be, that he doesn't take other people down with him. Let's get to Match Anatomy here on this show. This is the first Match Anatomy I've had time to do since episode 202, when I talked about the 1992 Royal Rumble match. And here we are on 214, and I thought that this Match Anatomy was perfect. Absolutely perfect to do now, given the fact that we are but 2 weeks away from a Brock Lesnar-John Cena match on pay-per-view at Extreme Rules. And some people out there may not be aware of the fact that 9 years ago, this very month, on this very show, which back then was called Backlash, Brock Lesnar and John Cena had a match. In fact, it might have been their only match. It definitely was their only pay-per-view match for the WWE Championship. It took place at Backlash in 2003. The month after Lesnar beat Kurt Angle to win the championship at WrestleMania 19 in Seattle. And interesting item here that comes from the Pro Wrestling Torch. They had a news item up a few weeks ago that I thought was kind of interesting and I don't necessarily buy into. 9 years ago, Brock Lesnar apparently was not very fond of a young John Cena. For whatever his reasons were, he did not like John Cena. John Cena, of course, back then was on the rise in WWE, on his ascent. He was a heel at the time, doing his rapper gimmick. A lot of stories, according to the Torch, behind the scenes to verify this. Mostly a case where Lesnar just absolutely hated this man for whatever his reasons were, and he would badmouth Cena backstage to anybody who would listen, to Vince McMahon. Anytime Cena was doing something that was looked at as improving or something good, Lesnar would be right there to bat him down to the suits in the back. And whether or not that had anything to do with some of the sloppy work that we'll talk about here in a moment in this match, that I don't know that, you know, Brock Lesnar tried to sabotage John Cena in this match at Backlash 9 years ago. I've watched the match now, and I don't buy into that. I don't necessarily doubt that Brock Lesnar hated John Cena back then. Brock Lesnar strikes me as the kind of guy that probably hates everybody. Probably would hate you. He would hate me if he met us. He probably hates everybody. So yes, I can easily buy into the fact that he looked at this young punk, you know, wannabe rapper back then and said, I don't like this guy. And I'm going to do everything in my power to try to make sure you know, that the people backstage know about this. But I don't think Brock would have gone out there and intentionally had a bad match just to make John Cena look bad. And as we'll get into here, it really wasn't a bad match that these two guys had, but it also wasn't good. I'd like to think that 9 years later, these guys obviously have a lot more seasoning and They'll go out there and have a great match at Extreme Rules. In this particular match, they didn't seem to have the best of chemistry, though. And ironically, here at Backlash, 9 years ago, we have yet another pay-per-view where The Rock is the featured performer in the main event. He is in a special attraction match against Bill Goldberg. That was the main event of the show. It was Goldberg's first match in WWE. And it wasn't for the championship, but it was the main event on the show. In fact, the WWE title match on this pay-per-view between Lesnar and Cena wasn't even the second-to-last match. It was the third-to-last match, relegated to the undercard. There was actually a Chris Jericho, Triple H, Ric Flair against Shawn Michaels, Kevin Nash, Booker T. Six-man tag team match that aired after this title match did. So the way this match came about, John Cena won a tournament on SmackDown to determine who would face Brock Lesnar for the WWE Championship. He beat Eddie Guerrero in the first round. He beat The Undertaker in the second round. Back then, the members of the FBI, the full-blooded Italians, had it in for The Undertaker. They interfered in the match, beat him down. That allowed Cena to get the win. So, hey, there you go. Undertaker, all these years later at WrestleMania, he should want his revenge on John Cena. But anyway, Cena beat Undertaker in the semifinals, and in the finals of this tournament, he beat Chris Benoit. And so, therefore, John Cena earned himself a crack at Brock's WWE Championship. He came out for this match in Massachusetts, mind you. Okay, this is where the pay-per-view was. It was in New England. Cena's backyard, right? He's from West Newbury. Remember the promo last year on Raw when CM Punk and John Cena went face-to-face after the... wasn't the contract signed. It was when Vince McMahon was trying to sign CM Punk to a new contract. Cena came out. This was right before Money in the Bank. Punk made the comment, "You're just like the New York Yankees," and that set Cena off. Oh, to compare John Cena from New England, you know, to the New York Yankees is like blasphemy, and Cena punched him in the face. Well, guess what? John Cena came out in Massachusetts for this match wearing a Yankees jersey and a Yankees baseball cap. He was a heel at the time. He said that he flat out said that Massachusetts sucks. This again from the man from West Newbury. I still cannot believe that he was rocking those jean shorts in this match, and 9 years later he is still rocking the same jean shorts. I just cannot even fathom this. So much for those camo shorts. I thought he was trying to do something different. I guess he retired the camo shorts. So Brock Lesnar comes out. He was a lot bigger back then. That's the first thing I noticed. Just a big, beefy bull of a guy. And he comes out. John Cena goes on the attack first. Brock quickly fights back. Gives Cena a Scott Hall-style fall-away slam, being that we were just talking about Scott Hall. I mean, he nearly tossed Cena into the front row. He gave him such a fall-away slam. So Brock goes on. He dominates the match for several minutes before Cena finally turns the tables, gives Brock an Irish whip into the steel steps on the outside. And Brock had a wound on his head, his forehead, because on the go-home SmackDown show before this pay-per-view, Cena had clobbered him with the Undisputed Championship belt, and that opened Brock up. So Brock now has been lacerated. The wound has been reopened, and we see something in this match that I can guarantee we will not see in 2 weeks at Extreme Rules unless it's hard way, and that is blood. So we got blood in this match pretty quickly from Brock Lesnar. And again, over time, it was kind of rubbing off on Cena. And, you know, I will maintain that blood really does add something to these matches. I'm not saying it should be done all the time. I applaud WWE, whatever their reasons were, for telling these guys, "We're no longer going to let you cut yourselves." That's not a bad thing. I'm just saying that when you see blood in some of these old matches, you realize that it just really does add an element that's missing, I think, from a lot of main events, especially when they do gimmicks like Hell in a Cell. How can you have a Hell in a Cell match or a hardcore-style match or anything like that and not have blood? It just doesn't make sense. So anyway, we got some color pretty early on in this match. The problem I had is that the crowd just really didn't seem to care much about the match, especially when Cena was on offense and in control. Probably because they just didn't take John Cena very seriously as a title contender. It just really illustrates the difference between then and now where, you know, even though people may hate Cena's guts, his matches get a reaction from the crowd no matter what. You know, when John Cena comes out for a match, it's going to elicit a reaction. You're going to have the "Let's go Cena," "Cena sucks," people are going to be screaming and hollering, and they're almost always full of noise, and it's just almost weird to go back and watch one of these old John Cena matches, and the crowd is virtually dead. That's the one thing I can say, whether you love the guy or hate the guy, I understand why WWE wants him in the spot that he's in and loves sending him out there, and they don't necessarily care that people are booing him even though he's supposed to be a babyface, because at least they're not sitting on their hands, which is what they were doing, I think, through much of this match. About 10 minutes in, I would estimate Lesnar, he nailed a massive spine buster. Must have lifted Cena a good 10 feet off the mat. Cena ends up coming back again, locks up Lesnar in a full-body grapevine sleeper for several minutes. This just was insufferable. This went on for way too long. It was just way too boring. I mean, he literally wrapped his legs around Lesnar's body, got him down, put him in I guess, a form of a sleeper, and just laid there. They laid there for literally a full 2.5 to 3 minutes doing nothing. That's a surefire way to get people to not give a shit about the match. And the fans did start a Let's Go Cena chant around this point, which was kind of surprising, but it was his hometown after all. But it just didn't feel right hearing them chant Let's Go Cena without the Cena sucks at the end. I just instinctively expected it, and then it never came, and I was kind of taken off guard by that. Lesnar eventually struggled to his feet. With Cena still on his back, he was able to get him off, and this is where the match got really sloppy. And in the torch item that mentioned the heat 9 years ago between Lesnar and Cena, Wade Keller, I guess it was, mentioned the fact, you know, he didn't say that this is what happened, but he speculated that perhaps because of that hatred that Lesnar supposedly had for Cena, maybe he tried to make him look bad on purpose. This is where the match for a few minutes fell apart. It wasn't really nearly as bad as he kind of painted it out to be. So again, I doubt that Lesnar tried to make Cena look bad on purpose at this point in the match. It just looked like things just fell apart. Lesnar went to whip Cena into the corner, and suddenly Cena stopped and sort of went to reverse Brock in, but either he realized that he fucked up or Brock simply wasn't cooperating, so Lesnar just moved him. He shoved him back into the corner himself, gave him a pair of shoulder blocks to Cena's ribcage. Then Lesnar went to whip Cena into the opposite corner, and again, he went for a reversal, but this time Brock didn't go. So it was, again, a case where either Cena fucked up or maybe Brock got confused. It's hard to tell. I do know that whatever it was, it looked really, really bad. Like, you know, you'll watch Divas matches every now and then, and you just reach that point where things just fall apart. Everything they do is just not working. And for a good 2 minutes or so here, that's what was happening in this match. Lesnar just got frustrated, it looked like, at that point. He didn't know what to do. He tried to salvage things. He just violently hoisted Cena up onto his shoulder and gave him a power slam, a standing power slam for a two count. Things did get better at this point. The referee got distracted. Cena nailed Brock with a low blow, got a roll up for a near fall. The fans actually were very disappointed when Brock kicked out. And, you know, that's an interesting point to bring up now that I think about it, that, you know, here's Brock Lesnar, who just won the WWE Championship from Kurt Angle the month before. He is positioned as the top babyface, certainly one of the top babyfaces in the company. And even then, 9 years ago, when Brock was on top, supposed to be the babyface, obviously nothing like it is now with Cena, but there were a contingent of fans, at least in this match, who were booing him. And I wonder why that is. Are they booing him because they were just trying to be anti-establishment and going against the grain? Were they booing him because they were in Massachusetts? And so they were going to cheer for John Cena no matter what? I don't know, but it's interesting that there's always, I think, certainly if you go back the last 10, 12 years, this is not a new phenomenon of people that the company is, you know, trying to push as like a top babyface, and there's always going to be a contingent of fans that rebel against that. It's just that with John Cena, I've never seen it so vociferous as it is with John Cena, but you were even seeing that here a little bit with Brock Lesnar, which is kind of interesting. So Brock kicks out. Cena tried to use his chain as a weapon. Back then, Cena would come to the ring with a chain and a lock around his neck. Referee caught him. He grabbed the chain, tossed it out of the ring, and then Lesnar caught Cena with an F5, and that's all she wrote. 1-2-3, Brock Lesnar retains the WWE Championship. I believe the month after this was when Brock had his stretcher match at Judgment Day with Big Show, which was maybe the best Brock-Big Show match of the series that they had. The point being, Cena didn't get a rematch after this. It was kind of a one-and-done type of thing. Cena was still very green and got his one match, and that was it. So this was the one Brock Lesnar-John Cena match. from back in the day, and I thought it would be appropriate to just kind of look back on it here as we approach the modern-day adaptation of Lesnar vs. Cena. There will be no titles on the line this time, but this might give us a little bit of insight into the kind of match they might have at Extreme Rules, and if that's the case, I would hope that 9 years later, both these guys can go in there and have a great match, but if this match is any indication, they could have a decent match, not a great match. This was not a great match. And again, I don't think Brock intentionally tried to sabotage it. It wasn't like he was no-selling any of Cena's offense for the other 17 minutes of a 20-minute match. I think Brock actually did a decent job of trying to make Cena look like a formidable challenger in this match, but there were way too many slow spots. There was that one point where everything just kind of fell apart, and then they went to the finish and Brock won. So anyway, that was Backlash in 2003. Very odd to go back and watch that match and just knowing how things are now. Just very bizarre, but very cool nonetheless to go back every now and then and kind of look back on that. And there you go. So that's Match Anatomy here for episode 214. You could, of course, submit your own ideas for any matches you'd like for me to review. I still have a whole backlog of matches that you guys have suggested, but if anybody suggests something that actually kind of raises my eyebrows or piques my interest, I might go with that before anything else. So let's move on now to the shout-outs. Sound off shout-outs. I know that some of you think it's the best part of the show. It'd be hard to argue that. After all, it's not about me. It's about you guys. You can submit mailbag questions and shout-outs, by the way, to the same email address. It's all the same. TheSolemonster@gmail.com. Glenn from Orlando wrote in, "Hey, Solemonster." He is Lupine MP3J, for those of you who comment on the articles on SE Scoops. That is Glenn. He wanted just to let me know that he had left a glowing review for the show in iTunes, so I wanted to thank him publicly for that. You can, of course, submit reviews for this show anytime you want to on iTunes. You can just leave a star rating, or you can actually write a little bit of a review, which I always love reading. So if you would be so kind to do that, you can find the show in the iTunes store by typing in Solemonster, or just type in Solemonster Sounds Off. And very easy to leave a review for the show, and it helps the show out, so I appreciate that. Daniel Trower writes in, he says, "Hey, Solemonster, can I get a shout-out on 214? I'm turning 22 and would love a birthday shout-out." So happy birthday, Daniel. Francisco Rodriguez writes in, "I was hoping I can get a shout-out. My birthday is on April 27th. I'll be turning 27. This week, I'll be traveling outside the country for a couple of months and won't be able to listen to the Sound Off as often as I normally do." Why? We have people all over the world listening to the Sound Off. Literally, all over the world. U.S., Canada, U.K., Germany, Spain, Italy, France, the Russian Federation, Afghanistan, Israel, Poland, Czech Republic. God, I mean, there are people all over the planet that listen to this show. And, what, are you being incarcerated or something? You have to serve time for something? Come on. Anyway, happy birthday, Francisco. Dakota Maxwell writes in, "Hey, Solemonster, it is my girlfriend Olivia's birthday, and our anniversary is coming up in a couple of days. Can we get a shout-out? We both have been listening to the show since around episode 75. Keep up the good work." Episode 75. That was the Michael Jackson rant, I believe, was episode 75. Webmaster Mike's favorite episode still to this day. He loves that show. Happy birthday to Olivia, and thanks to both of you. I like hearing from people who say that they listen to the show with somebody else, like a child or their girlfriend or their boyfriend or something. I just think that's really cool, so... happy birthday to her, and happy anniversary to the two of you. So we have, those are the shout-outs for this week. If you have more, again, you can email me, thesolemonster@gmail.com is the email address for anything and everything related to this show. And we'll do some mailbag questions now. It's been a while since I've been able to get to some of these, but we're going to try to get to a whole bunch here. This first question comes from Matt. "Do you know the specifics on Edge's career-ending injury? What caused his spinal stenosis? Was it during a specific match or from a specific bump that he took? The reason I ask is because I just got done watching his hardcore match with Mick Foley at WrestleMania 22 and was shocked at how he looked when it ended. Physically speaking, he looked completely shaken up. He was pale-faced, and his body was almost convulsing. I've never seen a match where a participant looked that immediately after it ended. Do you think it's possible he sustained a major injury during this match that led to the spinal stenosis?" No. That was Edge doing a very good job. I think it was a combination of Edge both probably being fucked up from the match, but it was just a very good job of selling on his part. Remember, the final spot of that match was Edge spearing Mick Foley through a flaming table on the outside. So, in theory, if not in real life, Edge was also caught up in some of the flames during that final spot and probably had some of his skin singed off. So that was, you know, the convulsing and the and that kind of stuff, which I remember, actually. I think Lita also took some abuse. She may have actually had some barbed wire, if I remember correctly, wrapped around her, and she was bleeding as well. That was just a really good job by Edge of selling, coupled with him probably really being a little bit shaken up, but the spinal stenosis had nothing to do with that match. The spinal stenosis, as Edge has told the story, had more to do, and I think we may have actually talked to him about this in our interview in Miami 2 weeks ago, but it had more to do with something that gradually happened over time. It was not one specific bump. It was not one specific injury. It was over the course of his career, particularly from those tag matches with Edge and Christian, the Hardys and the Dudleys, and all those crazy, wacky spots in those TLC matches, all the ladder matches that Edge was a part of. It took its toll. It would take its toll on anybody. And Edge had spinal fusion surgery back in, I believe, 2003. It could have been late 02, maybe early 03. It's probably actually later in 02, which was the same surgery that Rhino, Chris Benoit, Steve Austin, Lita actually herself, they had, you know, Test, they all had the spinal fusion that keeps you out for a minimum of 1 year. And I think what happened is he may have already had a little bit of spinal stenosis at that point. I'm sure the doctors told him and warned him that, over time, the neck might get worse. I think that's one of the things that led to Steve Austin retiring when he did in 03. You know, his neck you can only take so much abuse. And you can't just have a surgery like that and expect to just go back to wrestling just like you did before and everything's going to be okay. At some point, it's going to get worse. It's going to catch up with you. I think that's what happened with Edge. It just got to the point where he was starting to feel these tingling sensations, and he knew that something wasn't right, and his doctor looked and said, "That's it, you're done. You know, it has progressed to a point now where we can no longer allow you to continue doing what you're doing." So that's what it was. Kyle from Louisville writes in, "Dear Solomonster, been a loyal listener since episode 120. For next year's show, WrestleMania that is, I would love to see Undertaker come out and cut a promo about how there is no one left to challenge him for the streak and that everyone is too afraid to fight him after what he did to Triple H. Cue Sheamus' music, and out comes the Celtic Warrior to face the dead man, and he utters one phrase, 'I'll fight you, fella.' Then allow him to brogue kick Undertaker to get people thinking he could be the one to end the streak. Sorry to ramble, just some fantasy booking. Have a great day." Obviously, you're not going into WrestleMania without already having an Undertaker match announced. It's not a situation where WrestleMania 29, is going to go on the air and the Undertaker is going to come out for like a surprise promo or something unannounced. That's just not going to happen. But I do like Sheamus as an opponent, if not John Cena, for the Undertaker. And the idea that as soon as the bell rings, he nails Taker with a bro kick to get people thinking that he might end the streak. I mean, after what happened this year with Daniel Bryan in 18 seconds, that right there, right at the start of the match, might be the best shot that you have at getting people to jump out of their seat and say, "Holy shit, tell me they're not going to really do this," and then have Undertaker kick out. So I like the idea. I still like John Cena better as an opponent, though. But if not, I think Sheamus would be a fine opponent and somebody who has never had a match before with The Undertaker. John Cena has faced The Undertaker, never at a WrestleMania. But I'm pretty sure the last match Taker and Cena had was probably 03 or something like that. Chuck from Big Rock, Illinois writes in, "I see what you mean now about the moods John Cena is in when he comes out. He bitch slaps Brock Lesnar and gets cut open for his trouble. Then Lesnar tells him that he can't hold his jock. And what does Cena do? He comes out all smiles, the same as always, when they try to make it out that he is pissed. Michael Cole even had the nerve to say, 'Oh, the mood that Cena is in.' If you mean seemingly content with getting hit in the mouth and called out with a big smile, then for once, Michael Cole, you are right. All I'm saying is that it's a far cry from when wrestlers' music used to hit and they would fly down to the ring at 100 miles an hour when they were mad. It's the little things like this that make me not care about John Cena as a superstar." That comes from Chuck, and it's hard to argue with. Again, there's a time and a place to smile and smirk and be happy and jolly. Obviously, this is not Steve Austin, like Chuck said, running down to the ring at a million miles an hour to go kick somebody's ass. But not everybody needs to be Steve Austin either. But it would be nice if John Cena could just get a little more serious in situations like this. He's had a very bad couple of weeks in storyline. I mean, come on. This big match that he went on television and said, "I have everything to lose in this match. I have to beat The Rock." And then, of course, The Rock beat him. And did it really make a goddamn bit of difference in the career of John Cena? Of course not, even though he did look like a bitch. But he lost to The Rock at WrestleMania after a year-long build-up. He got beaten up and embarrassed by Brock Lesnar. Now 2 weeks in a row, mind you. He has been left laying at the end of the show. But I would expect that Cena will be out there in London on Raw this week, probably hamming it up as always. And there is a time and a place when this guy needs to come out and just let us know that you actually care. Just come out and let us know that you're actually upset, that you're actually not a cyborg, you have human emotions. It would be nice. That's all I'm saying. Tane writes into the Sound Off here. Dear Solomonster, I appreciate your hard work. Would like to say thank you for the countless times you have saved me from boredom during Double Math. His birthday is actually coming up on November 10th. He's turning 16, so I missed including that in the shout-out, so I'll include it here. But he actually has a question as well. Does the IWC frustrate you sometimes? The Rock comes back, yet they complain. They also complain about there not being enough young talent, yet Cody Rhodes, Sheamus, and Dolph Ziggler are being built up. Lastly, they complain about Daniel Bryan's title run. At least he got to hold the World Heavyweight Championship. Thanks for all your hard work. Sorry if the message dragged a little bit. No, it didn't drag at all. You make a very valid point. Listen, I will complain about the fact that there's not enough newer guys being built up. I think it's not even so much that. There is a lot of newer faces on the roster that they're trying to build up. Cody Rhodes, you mentioned, although, again, now he's being made out to look like a fool and be embarrassed on TV every week. But, you know, building Cody Rhodes, building Sheamus back up, Wade Barrett when he comes back, supposedly there's big plans for Wade Barrett when he comes back. You've got Ryback who just debuted. You've got Dean Ambrose who will probably be on TV soon. Seth Rollins, another guy. This Damian Sandow guy debuting soon. So there's definitely young talent out there. The Daniel Bryan thing I agree with you on because you have not heard me complain about the fact that Daniel Bryan now is dead because they took the title off him. I don't think Daniel Bryan is dead. I would not have taken the title off him just because I thought he was doing such an awesome job as this cocky chicken shit heel. You could have kept that title on him for a little bit longer. I sure as hell wouldn't have had him lose it the way that he did at WrestleMania. But I said before he even lost the championship, I said there was one episode of The Sound Off maybe a month or two ago, and I made a comment about the fact that, listen, for the people complaining about how CM Punk is being booked and how Daniel Bryan is being booked, both of these guys, after a couple of months, are still our world champions. Punk is the WWE champ. Bryan is the world champ. Let's just sit back and enjoy it because it's not going to last forever. And, of course, Daniel Bryan now is no longer the world heavyweight champion. But I think it's awesome that he actually held the title for a couple of months. Even he has said in interviews that he was shocked that he even held it as long as he did. He thought for sure at the Rumble he'd be dropping it. And when he realized at Elimination Chamber, when he retained his title, that that meant he probably would be holding it through WrestleMania, he was overjoyed. He had a hell of a run. He filled his role perfectly, and he got himself over, you know, with the Yes chant, and his new T-shirt is selling very well, and I think people look at him now differently than they did a year ago. They may not look at him on the same level as a John Cena yet. I think in time they might. But they look at it, it's almost like there's two subcategories of being a top guy. You've got your tippy top guy, like a John Cena, Triple H, Shawn Michaels, but you have somebody that people can look at as a top guy and not as a mid-card kind of jabroni. And I think, you know, somebody like Sheamus, for example, is in a role like that now. Randy Orton is kind of an odd case because Randy Orton hadn't really done anything of any great substance since he lost the title to Mark Henry last year. If anything, it's actually quite shocking to see the descent or the de-evolution in many ways of Randy Orton as a main eventer in WWE. But Daniel Bryan at one point was losing matches every week. He was having matches with nothing but mid-card guys. I'd like to think that now he has reached that point where even if he does get pushed down the card a little bit more, WWE knows what they have with this guy. They know how good he is. Everybody else knew how good he was, but it took them a little bit longer to figure it out. I think they've reached that point. I think he's in good shape right now. And I enjoyed the hell out of his world title run. You won't hear me complaining about the fact that, oh my God, he's no longer the champion. Would I have done it? No. But to the people who will complain, they're going to complain no matter what. There's nothing you can do about it. People would have complained about Steve Austin hogging up the spotlight. If you had, and there was an internet wrestling community back then, it might not have been as robust as it is now. But I'm willing to bet you that back then you had plenty of people who were bitching and moaning that, oh, I'm so sick of The Rock. I'm so sick of Steve Austin. Every week he comes out, he drinks beer, he flips people off. It's boring. We need somebody new. You're always going to have people who complain no matter what. That's just the way it is. Karsh Raj from India writes in, Dear Solomonster, Ring Ka King is apparently the most watched wrestling program in the world, averaging 10 million viewers per episode. If India had a pay-per-view system, TNA could have made a killing. Vince McMahon has to be kicking himself right now. What do you think about this? What's there to be kicking yourself about? You know, the reality is, I mean, first of all, if it was pay-per-view, that doesn't mean all 10 million people would actually put money down. I would be willing to bet that a lot of people, I don't know what the percentage is, but a lot of people who watch Ring Ka King in India perhaps are from low-income families. They don't do very well. I think the demographics would probably be very similar to the way it is in this country. There's a very high percentage of people who don't make a lot of money here in the U.S., who are, you know, who comprise the wrestling fan demographic. I would imagine it's the same in India. I know there's a lot of you know, parts of India that are very very poor, and I'm sure a lot of those people probably watch Ring Ka King. And if Ring Ka King was on pay per view, and I don't know what the denomination is in India compared to the way it is here, but whatever you charge for it, believe me, a lot of those 10 million people are not going to plunk down money to watch Ring Ka King. It's different. If you are offering something for free on television as opposed to putting it on pay-per-view, it makes a world of difference. I give TNA credit for having the foresight to try something in the Indian market, knowing that there was a market for wrestling there, and apparently Ring Ka King is doing very well. Not quite as well as it was doing when it first started, but it's still doing pretty good. I don't know, by the way, I'm just assuming that that 10 million viewer number you gave me is accurate. I haven't actually checked it out myself. If it isn't accurate, I'm sure it's not that far off. There are a lot of people over there. And right now it's a novelty. Again, Ring Ka King is still relatively new in a year. Are there going to be 10 million people watching it? Are they going to grow that 10 million people to maybe 12 or 13 million people? I don't know. I know that's a very big population over there. It could certainly get bigger than it is now. Vince McMahon, the thing about WWE in India, it's been a long time since WWE has had a tour in India. And if I'm not mistaken, the last tour there was probably 02 or 03 maybe, and that might have been the tour where a lot of people got sick. And William Regal almost died. So they've been very hesitant to go back there. There were even some talents who went on that tour who said, and they just say this, who knows if they would actually follow through, but they said, listen, if you book another tour of India and you tell me I have to go, I'm going to quit before I go back there. And it has nothing to do with the people. It just has to do with the fact that a lot of people got sick from the food. Maybe it was the water supply. I don't know what it was. And some guys were actually very depressed going over to India because they saw a lot of areas that just were like slums, and they saw these poor families and these kids running around, and it depressed the hell out of them. So a lot of people had no interest in going back to India, and I don't think they've been back. Now, that doesn't mean they'll never go back at all. I think there are far too many people over there with money to be made to not go back there. But I don't think Vince McMahon is kicking himself. In fact, I bet if you said Ring Ka King to Vince, he'd probably say Gesundheit. I don't even think he necessarily even knows what that is. I really don't. I don't think he follows that all that closely. I'm sure other people in the company do, and they're well aware of it. But WWE is, you know, they're focusing their efforts. They have, right now, they're on tour of Europe. They're in, I think, Ireland and Germany. And normally when they go overseas for tours, they usually do pretty well in Europe. They do pretty well in Australia. I think they're doing okay on the international stage. I don't think they're kicking themselves too much. Vince writes into the Sound Off, not that Vince, although this is a question about Vince McMahon. Do you believe that Vince McMahon from 1999 would be ashamed of Vince McMahon of 2012? Maybe of the current Vince McMahon's haircut, he might be ashamed, but otherwise I don't see any reason why he would be. Why would he be ashamed of the fact that, you know, in the 12 years since then, or 13 years, or whatever it's been, his company, even though business is kind of soft right now, has grown even bigger. I mean, the company now, compared to the way it was in 99, I know that was the boom period and everything and the ratings were great, but the company now is much bigger than it was then. They have so many more revenue streams. They're launching a network. They have a movie division. I don't think he has any reason to be ashamed, quite frankly. He should be more ashamed of booking decisions and stuff. I mean, if that's what you're asking, I don't think he would be, because I don't think Vince looks at it like that. We can look at it and go, wow, you know, there's been a lot of really shitty ideas, and creative is not what it used to be. And Vince would probably look at you and just call you a mark and say that you don't know what the hell you're talking about. So I don't think he would be ashamed at all. Paul Holloway writes in from Hazleton, Pennsylvania. Solomonster, I became a fan of your show at episode 211. This is my first question. Who in your mind, whether it be WWE, TNA, ROH, is the greatest heel at this point in time, and who would you put them against in a storyline? I would say of those three, in all honesty, Bully Ray has got to be the best heel. I mean, it's just amazing to me to really look at this guy. How many years he was stuck in a tag team, and he breaks out on his own the second time. Because remember, he broke out as a singles star in WWE the first time, and then they ended up putting the Dudleys back together. But he breaks out on his own again and completely reinvents himself, and he gets himself in better shape. They let him talk, which is really what his strong point is. I mean, if you remember the old Bubba Ray character in the original ECW, I mean, you know the guy could talk, and you know the guy's got a foul mouth. So he goes out there, and to me, he's probably the best heel in the business right now. Just no redeeming qualities whatsoever. He doesn't go out there to try to be a babyface, to try to be like a cool heel. He'll go out there, he'll get up in your face, he'll, you know, rip a sign out of an old lady's hand at ringside and tear it into a million pieces. He's great. And as far as who I would put him in the ring with, there's really no matchup in TNA with him that excites me. I feel like he's faced everybody already. What I would love to see, I think would actually, probably more so on the microphone than in the ring, but I think would be a hell of a feud, is Bully Ray and CM Punk. I think Bully Ray and CM Punk, you put those two guys in a ring together with a mic in hand, and I think that right there would be supremely entertaining. So, yeah, I mean, if I had the ability to bring Bully Ray over to WWE, let's say when his contract expired and he wanted to come back, I think Bully Ray is a singles heel towards the top in WWE could work, and I think Ray and Punk would be a hell of a feud. Last question here comes from CJ, a Solomonster, longtime listener for a long time now. I was doing some investigating into The Undertaker's streak. I realized that he did not compete at WrestleManias 10 or 16. My question is why, and if he did, who do you think he would have been in the ring against? And by the way, if he had competed in these two WrestleManias and won, then Undertaker vs. Shawn Michaels 2 at WrestleMania 26 would have been 20-0. That's a good point, actually. That would have been, to me, that would have been more appropriate. You have streak versus career between Michaels and The Undertaker, and Undertaker wins and goes 20-0, and Shawn has to retire. That would have been pretty cool. But no, the reason he was off for WrestleMania 10, there's different stories out there as far as why. The story I had always heard, and I believe to be true, is that Undertaker had requested some time off. I believe his wife at the time was giving birth to their child. And he had been given time off, although I think he might have been first, he might have been competing actually overseas for WWE, which is a little bizarre. But he had taken many months off after being defeated by Yokozuna in that casket match at the Royal Rumble. Had he been at WrestleMania 10, it would have been with Yokozuna since the two of them were still programmed together. You know, I guess they could have given him some other opponent, but being that he was just beaten by Yoko, that would have made sense, and he wasn't getting a title match. So perhaps they felt like, okay, this is the perfect opportunity for him to take some time off. So to the best of my knowledge, it had more to do with that than any particular injury. You know, he wasn't suspended or anything like that. As far as WrestleMania 16, that was due to an injury. Undertaker had actually taken off the year before, and it was kind of a sudden thing because The Undertaker at the time was the Ministry Undertaker. He was with the Ministry of Darkness, and he was going to be part of a pay-per-view main event in September of 1999 at a pay-per-view called Unforgiven, and it was going to be the first ever six-pack challenge for the WWF Championship. It was going to be The Rock, Triple H, Kane, Mankind, Undertaker, and I might be missing one person, Big Show, I believe, and Steve Austin was going to be the special guest enforcer for this match. Undertaker was in the match, and then they did this angle where Undertaker walked out on one episode. The reason they did that was because he was hurt. I think he needed surgery. He was all banged up. I mean, Undertaker has always been banged up. So British Bulldog ended up taking his spot in that match. That was September of 99. I believe the original plan was for Undertaker to come back in late January, maybe early February. For sure, he was going to be back before WrestleMania. And if you recall, there was an episode of SmackDown. It might have been the February 7th episode. Not SmackDown, Raw. It might have been the February 7th Raw. If that was a Monday, then it was definitely that show. Had one of the all-time great matches in Raw history. All-time great matches in Raw history. It was a 10-man tag from Dallas. I'll never forget it. It was at the Reunion Arena. It was The Rock, Cactus Jack, Rikishi, and Too Cool against Triple H and the Radicals. It was Perry Saturn, Dean Malenko, and I think Chris Benoit. Actually, I'm sorry, it was Triple H, X-Pac, Perry Saturn, and Chris Benoit, and maybe Dean Malenko was in the match. Eddie Guerrero was not, because he had been injured, so he was in their corner. And actually, it's kind of sad, because when you think about it, that makes at least two, probably a hell of a lot more than two, but at least two all-time great Raw matches that we'll never hear about because of Chris Benoit's involvement. Benoit was in this match, so WWE will never acknowledge it. Just like that tag match when it was Benoit and Jericho against Triple H and Austin, which was a phenomenal match, but we'll never hear about it because Benoit was in it, so that sucks. Anyway, the point is, on that show, when that 10-man tag was over, Paul Bearer came out, and he had not been seen for a long time. This was his big return. And the belief was that that was the show The Undertaker was going to be on. And everybody first, I think, thought that Paul Bearer was coming out to reintroduce The Undertaker. In fact, he was reintroducing Kane, which is kind of funny because I think Kane had been off television literally for like 2 or 3 weeks. He was not gone very often, but he brought back Kane, and Kane had kind of a new outfit, and people went nuts for it. Undertaker in training, if I remember correctly, tore his pec. So he was already off for many months. He was going to be back on that show. He tore his pec. I think they slotted Kane in that spot instead, and Undertaker now had to heal from the torn pec, and that kept him out a couple more months. He missed WrestleMania, but he did come back in May at Judgment Day when Rock and Triple H had their Iron Man match. Undertaker debuted as the American Badass. So that's what happened. He wasn't at 16 for sure because of an injury. 10, I don't think, had anything to do with an injury. And I'm sure, you know, it's interesting to think because back then they were not acknowledging the streak, especially WrestleMania 10. So it's not out of the realm of possibility that had The Undertaker competed on both of those shows. In fact, I would argue that it's quite likely Undertaker would have lost one of those matches. And had he lost one of those matches, we would not now have the streak. So, you know, they say in life things happen for a reason. Perhaps in this instance, this is a great example of things happening for a reason. And, yeah, he happened to miss those two shows. And because he missed those two shows, he couldn't lose. So there you go. Now we have 20-0 all these years later. Pretty impressive. That's going to do it for the mailbag this week. Going to cinch this bad boy back up and tuck it underneath the table here. We'll get back to the mailbag next week. If you have questions to send in, email me at thesolemonster@gmail.com. I do read everything. I try to get back to as many people as I can. Any emails should go to that email address. You can follow me on Twitter, @solemonster. I want to say thank you to all of our new Twitter followers as well. There's live blogging that goes on during Raw and some other shows, and every now and then I'll post stuff that cannot be found anywhere else. So follow me on there. Friend me on Facebook as well, facebook.com/TheSolemonster. It's the show's official logo is the profile photo. And you have to friend me for access. So a lot of good stuff up there. Like I said, I have a photo gallery, 100 photos from WrestleMania weekend in Miami, from Mania, from Raw, from Access, from Wrestle Reunion. And you guys have been great with your comments. So if you haven't checked that out, there's some really good shit up there. So go check that out. There's some videos as well, of the Undertaker's entrance at WrestleMania that I recorded, so from a live perspective, what it was like to be in the stadium when the lights went out, and videos of me asking questions to, I think, Sheamus and The Rock at the press conference, all that good stuff. So friend me on Facebook for that. You can subscribe to the show in iTunes, which I encourage all of you to do if you haven't already done so, and find me on YouTube as well. My username is TheSolemonster, and yes, I am planning soon on putting up Vintage, episode number 3. Of the Sound Off. Any of these vintage shows that I put up from here on out will be on YouTube exclusively. So subscribe to me on there, and as soon as it goes up, you'll get a notification about that. So that's going to do it for this week. Again, pay your taxes if you haven't done that already, you bums. And we'll be back next weekend with episode 215 of the Solemonster Sounds Off here on SEScoops.com. Until then, be well, stay safe. A sincere thank you from me for supporting the show. Let everybody else know about it, too. That's even better. And we'll see you right back here next week. Take it easy, guys.
Let me tell you something, fella.
This is Joe from Northern Ireland.
Hi, I'm AJ Grimaldo.
And quite simply, the fastest 60 minutes on the internet.
The Solemonster Sounds Off on SEScoops.com.